Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We get out of the studio and onto the road to find the kind of radio you don't hear so much anymore. Stories off the beaten path and usually away from the top headlines. So send us a note if you have an idea or just want to say hi. Our email address is indianaweekend@gmail.com. This is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and the fact that organizers kicked it off from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston tells you they're not just talking about hacked Facebook accounts. People who've looked at this say we should be concerned about attacks on our banking system, the power grid, and yes, of course, our online identities. Fred Kate is a law professor and director of the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. I'm thinking it's the little things that can really cause problems. Giving your password away, that sort of thing. How much of this is our own fault, do you suppose?
Well, I'm so glad you raised that. I always try not to say our own fault because, it suggests that we've done something wrong when really the problem is we just don't do enough that's right. But it is absolutely true. If we look across the most successful attacks, whether they're big or little, the one thing they all have in common is there's been some human failing. And that failing is often falling victim to a phishing message. So, somebody sends you a message, it looks legitimate, they ask for your password or they ask for your login credentials, you provide it, and it turns out you've just provided that information to the bad guys. And, I mean, this happens all the time. It happens to major national security organizations. This is how the Chinese got access to the Joint Strike Fighter plans. Was by sending a phishing message to somebody at Lockheed Martin, which was developing the plane.
Now you have to tell us this story, okay? Kind of because this is our newest, the best that we had in terms of jet fighters, right?
You're absolutely right, and what they did is they sent a message pretending to be coming from the Pentagon procurement office, and anyone who works with the government knows how frequently you get these kind of bureaucratic messages. Filled with a lot of jargon, asking you to provide certain information to, update your status report or to indicate that you're spending the money correctly or whatever. In this case, part of the information was requested was access to the files, and this person provided it. It turned out they weren't providing it to the Pentagon. They were providing it to the Chinese. Now, I should say the government has maintained these were outdated plans that were obtained. But nevertheless, these are really the crown jewels of sort of American secrets. And the way they were gotten was through a common, ordinary, everyday phishing attack. And, a really common way we see successful attacks is the you bring your sick child to work. You try to entertain them by having them play on the computer. They install a program. They download something. They go to a site that looks like it's a children's site. And suddenly your computer's compromised when you're doing real work on it. Or easy-to-compromise phones. And so you use your phone or you use your iPad or your portable computer. You're out. You log into a wireless signal that you think, belongs to a reputable organization. But, how do you know when you're sitting there at Starbucks using that free wireless that it's the wireless you think it is as opposed to somebody else's wireless who's just collecting everything you're typing? And so it's not that it's easy, it's that it requires constant vigilance.
This whole idea of attacks launched against our information, we or the West, I guess you would say, has had some successes. Can you talk about what happened with the Iranian centrifuges?
Yeah, and this is frankly what makes it, speaking as a lawyer, it makes it all the more complicated to deal with because on the one hand, we don't like it when other countries do it to us, yet we also have aggressive cyber attack units in our U.S. military. And one of the earliest and most successful attacks that we now know about was an attack against the uranium centrifuge plants in Iran. And these are the plants that, purify the uranium to try to go from run-of-the-mill uranium to weapons-grade uranium. These were very secure plants. They were in the interior of Iran. They weren't going to be easily compromised, and they weren't on the network, so we couldn't attack them in the usual way. But instead, what we did was we provided those thumb drives. We corrupted them with a virus. Somebody who works at one of the uranium centrifuge facilities was at a conference, picked up one of the thumb drives, plugged it in, and we had written a virus that would work just on that one type of computer and caused it to do two things, to, on the one hand, spin faster than it was supposed to, and on the other hand, not show on the instrumentation that it was spinning faster. And as a result, we caused massive destruction within the centrifuge plant. U.S. intelligence estimates were at least a 40% degradation in the capacity of the Iranians to process weapons-grade uranium.
Occasionally, is this not true that one means is to leave a thumb drive out on the parking lot or something like that? Or just
Yeah, it's an amazing, again, the most human of things. So you find a thumb drive laying out in the parking lot. Even if you're just motivated by the best of intentions, you want to return it to the owner, the first thing you do is you come in and stick it in your computer to see if there's any indication of the owner. That's it. If it's got a virus, you've now got a virus. It's that easy. And so, again, think about all the times at, you know, state fairs, at professional conferences, that we pick up devices like thumb drives. They're free. They're given away. And we come right home and plug them in a computer, and if they're not secure, if our computers aren't secure, we're infected.
I think we're thinking a lot these days about information security at risk from a variety of directions.
No question about it, because if you think about it, I mean, we know, for example, we've got government incursions. We have them from our own government. We've learned over the summer about what the NSA has been up to. We've been complaining for quite some time about Chinese government incursions into information security of individuals and institutions. We have organized crime, which engages in particularly the theft of identity credentials, credit card numbers, and things like that on a massive scale. And then, of course, we still just have the run-of-the-mill hacker, the often the kid who just wants to see if he can do it, or whether he's carrying out some message unrelated to earning money that's not there.
There seems to be no way to get ahead of this, right? Because as soon as the good guys develop countermeasures, somebody else comes along with a better mousetrap of some kind.
I think that is right. I mean, you know, the most common metaphor we use is an arms race. And, one of the features of an arms race is you never get ahead, or you never get ahead for long before somebody comes along with a better weapon. I think the particular challenge in cybersecurity, and it's one that I don't think we give enough credence to, and that is, the good guys have to win every time. The bad guys only have to win once. And so it's not really a fair fight, if you will. It's what we often describe as an asymmetric threat, because if I'm defending a university or a company or even just my home computer, I've got to win against absolutely everybody out there. And if I lose once, I've lost.
Law Professor Fred Kate, Director of the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University, on how vulnerable we are through the various devices that connect us to the world, including, of course, our phones. For more information about Cybersecurity Awareness Month, check out staysafeonline.org.
Hello, Hal, can you read me?
Affirmative, I read you.
I want you to stop reading all my mail.
I'm sorry, I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Look, just stop reading our mail.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line to let us know what you think. Email indianaweekend@gmail.com.
My name is Deb Howe. I'm Assistant Director in the Office of Information Security. And this month, we're promoting cybersecurity awareness. We're a champion along with the National Alliance for Cybersecurity. And we're hoping this month we can raise awareness with our students, our faculty, and staff.
Apple's just come out with a new iPhone, and most new phone contracts sold today are for smart devices.
I don't think I read very much about antivirus software for my phone. I just assume that it's going to be safe. Anything in particular that phone or mobile device users should be aware of?
Well, of course, with phones, we're more concerned with apps. You know, people download apps. If it comes from a secure site, that has more to do. You know, it's usually, like you say, it's more safe. What you do find now is they had all these little add-ons called adware, where it says you're going to download this product. Well, this product is safe, but in addition to, we suggest you download this toolbar, and we suggest you download this. And unless you go out there and uncheck those, you're going to download them. So you try to avoid that type of adware on any system, but you see it more on, you know, when you see apps and that kind of thing. You know, my son is ready for a new phone, and we talked about, you know, going to get a new device. And you walk around Verizon, and everybody's so hyped, like you say, getting the new iPhone because it's got a new collar, or, you know, the new Droid's got this new capability. I didn't hear one person say, and what kind of security is on that phone? Or what kind of software, you know, should I buy to put on that phone? It's not something people think about. They want the convenience. They want the new gadget.
You're a mom.
I am a mom.
Have you ever been surprised by anything that your children have said, or have you ever said, now, wait a minute, do you understand what you're doing there?
Yes, I have. My daughter is an ICU nurse, and I get so upset when I go to her house and I look what's on her computer or what is not on her computer, and she always says, Mom, you're so boring. And, you know.
Well, no, why? I mean, you're saying, hey, you need to secure your information better.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and usually what ends up happening to my poor daughter is we redo the whole system, because it gets to the point, your system's so trashed, it's better just to start all over.
Reinstall the operating system.
Correct.
And your programs?
Yeah. Correct. My son is very savvy. He's in a TCOM major, actually, this year, but he is very savvy about computers, and sometimes he teaches me stuff because, you know, I talk about information security, and there's such a wide area in IT, so he informs me of some stuff that's going on, too, so I enjoy conversation with him.
What kind of a mom were you when these guys were younger? Were you tough? Hey, no, you can't have that. You got to keep that computer out in the den or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm very weary, and I'm always, you know, scared as a parent what people get into. Fortunately for my kids, it was setting out in the open because I live out in the boonies and we don't have high-speed internet. We had dial-up, so there wasn't a lot of systems going on, so the kids always had to be on the computer in front of me. But, you know, when my kids were, like my daughter, when she was younger, you know, we weren't doing Facebook. I mean, if you think 10 years ago, the only people had Facebook was at Harvard. And Twitter didn't exist. I mean, 10 years ago, we didn't need to know to be all this cyber secure. And as we grow, we do. So I wasn't as scared then as I am now.
You're more concerned now.
I'm very concerned. You know, I don't have any grandchildren, but I have nieces and nephews that, you know, I'm fearful for. And, you know, I sound like the lecturing mother or aunt, you know, well, do you do this? Do you do that? You know, you let him take it in his room. So, yeah, I'm probably annoying.
Deb Howell, Assistant Director of the Office of Information Security at Ball State University, talking about Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Coming up, more from lawyer Fred Cate on an interesting legal question. You know, all that data collection of phone records by the government? How legal is that?
I'm just an average man with an average life.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
This is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, brought to you by the Department of Homeland Security and something called the National Cybersecurity Alliance. Of course, along with the cyber threats from criminals, hackers, and foreign governments, we've recently learned more about threats to our information security from other directions. We talked about that with Fred Cate, an Indiana University law professor and director of the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. You're an attorney, and you consider the legal aspects of how information is protected and also how our government acts. The things that came to light over the summer with the Snowden case and so forth, it's confusing to some people, and I'm among them. Is the government breaking the law? What's happening when all this information is collected in this way, this metadata, for instance, about phone calls?
I think I'm confused, too. So we're all in this, I think, together. I think the best way, the best light you could put on it is to say that the government has stretched the law as far as it could conceivably go, far beyond what anyone intended at the time the law was enacted, and far beyond what anyone thought was happening. I think you could probably go farther than that. I mean, we know that senior administration officials lied before Congress about what the NSA was engaged in, and we know in some instances surveillance took place, which was against the law, because when the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court found out about it, it ordered the intelligence shut down. And so these activities clearly were outside of what the Foreign Intelligence Court thought were legal. But I think even more than the question of legal versus illegal is this notion of, in a classified environment, we obviously can't know all of the details of all of the things that our government is doing to make us more secure. But it does seem like it's part of the role of Congress and of, if you will, the public lawmaking process to set the broad contours of that. And I think what we know now is that the government is way beyond what we thought those broad contours were. So we thought under the Patriot Act that warrants would be filled out on one person at a time. It turned out, we've later learned, they've been filled out on 98 million people at a time, so that a single warrant could collect data, in this case the metadata on the Verizon customers' phone calls, with a single legal instrument, one warrant on 98 million people. And part of the reason this is so significant is because, for example, we require that the intelligence agencies report to Congress on how many of these documents they complete. We thought it was a one-to-one ratio. Now that we know there's no limit to the number of people you can surveil with a single warrant, all of that kind of data collection that Congress put in place as a protection has been proven meaningless.
How much confidence do you have in things such as the FISA court?
I think the one place where we really see the Snowden disclosures over the summer intersecting with cybersecurity most clearly is the extent to which every time we introduce a vulnerability into a system or a product so that our NSA can do surveillance, we introduce a vulnerability so that anybody can do surveillance. And this is a major concern. And, you know, there's actually sort of a funny story. You know, we broke into the United Nations network so that we could do arguably illegal surveillance. It certainly violated our treaty obligation with the UN. When we broke in, we found the Chinese had broken in as well. So there we were, two illegal surveillance groups working side by side to conduct surveillance of the United Nations. And I think in this sense, we should be very concerned. On the one hand, we think of the government as helping to secure our cyber infrastructure, and President Obama has talked a lot about this. On the other hand, we have to be honest, the government's done a huge amount, we now know, to make our cyber infrastructure less secure. And that's a problem when you think we're using taxpayer dollars to make our security weaker.
I would imagine that people advocating for these measures for national security would be loath to give this up. I mean, it's not a matter of another administration coming in, right?
You're absolutely right, and they have enormous power. And, of course, the security card, as we call it in political environment, you know, once you play the security card, you usually win that hand. I think, on the other hand, there is some reason to think, you know, even back to the time that the Fourth Amendment was adopted, the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution was adopted in large part because the British government was doing general surveillance. It was going house to house conducting searches. And, you know, the colonists and who later wrote the Constitution took the view that that was not permissible. It's highly effective. But even though it works as a deterrent for criminal activity, it's not lawful in this country because we don't permit general searches. And I think what we're going to have to do is kind of recapture that courage so that we say, look, even though conducting surveillance about everybody may help in some cases detect terrorism, we don't actually have much evidence of that, but one could believe that it's true, that nevertheless, as a society, we're going to have some values where we say we're going to draw a line here, not because we don't think it might work, but because we just don't think it's right.
When we talk about the measures the government has taken or the capabilities that are out there, the vulnerability, say, of our electric grid or of our banking system, What's the aspect of this that gives you nightmares?
Actually, a number of things. I mean, you've touched on several of them right there. I mean, one of the most troubling things to me is not thinking of information as information. Like, are my emails vulnerable? I don't really care. Read my emails. Have at them. But rather thinking about the places we use information to perform essential tasks, like fly airplanes or manage electricity grids or control monitors in hospital emergency rooms. And when we talk about security vulnerabilities or cybersecurity vulnerabilities, we're not just talking about data, like collections of data, like your documents. We're talking about any place data is used in an electronic system to accomplish a purpose. And, you know, the average American car today has more than a dozen computers. Medical devices like insulin pumps, these are just computers. We use these computers to maintain almost every aspect of our lives. Think about banking. You know, banks don't have money anymore. You couldn't go to your bank and ask to see your money. Instead, you see zeros and ones that convey to you your money. So all we need is enough vulnerability, enough sense that the system may not be accurate, and then we lose confidence. We lose faith. People, you know, we have a run on the banks. Or, you know, I think about this, I travel a lot. You know, you used to have a ticket. The ticket suggested you owned something of value. You know, I have a reservation and an airplane seat. Now I have an email. That's all I have to prove it. So if someone could start tinkering with those systems so that people showed up for their flights or for their theater tickets or for whatever they bought electronically and it's not there, then we're going to, the confidence of the country will crash, and it will make all of the debate over debt ceiling look completely unimportant.
Fred Kate, a law professor and director of the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. Something to think about, this lawyer and cybersecurity expert believes the vast government grabbing of phone information is, if not illegal, a real stretch of the law, likely a violation of the Fourth Amendment prohibiting general searches. But then he's saying, that's not the real problem. Go ahead and take my phone information. The real problem has to do, he says, with the security of computers that actually do things, like make your debit card work or make the lights come on when you flip the switch. Start taking away those things, and we'll look back fondly to the time when all we had to worry about were a few email snoops. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Marcus Jackman. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. If you're a hacker or have developed your own cyber integrity countermeasures, drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio, I'm John Strauss.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss of the Ball State Journalism Department. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Marcus Jackman. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture, Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from Flex Steel, Bassett, and Simmons Beautyrest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.